because it's hard challenges when you're in there, and then to eat, like, you get nothing for it other than the story, and it was just like, you should give me my freaking story. I came down this path for my story.
Live for the Mundangerous Gap here in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to Actual Play Episode 15 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're debriefing after our playthrough of 5th edition D&D's Sunless Citadel. What did we like? What did we change? What would we do differently? And of course, most importantly, how did we screw up? A lot.
Okay, so before we get into that, though, worth noting for posterity, right? We're now 6 years into this.
God, yes. During this AP hiatus, we hit 6 years.
It seems worth mentioning, I guess, through sheer inertia, that we should mention we are still in the height of the pandemic. Gen Con is in this weird hybrid format this year, 2021. And we are doing a panel for Gen Con online rather than attending.
Oh, yes. Oh, dear Lord. We are not attending. But you can tune in on Saturday, September 18th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on Zoom for our panel, Skin Deep, playing realistic non-human RPG characters.
If you go to gencon.com/events, you can search for Total Party Thrill. You can get a free ticket, and that will ensure that you get the link, I guess. It's confusing how that's going to work.
Yeah, you'll get a Zoom link at some point. There's also a link in the show notes for this episode. We're going to expand upon stuff we've talked about on the show before. What is it like to play non-human characters? How do you take into account different physiologies, different psychologies, different social outlooks, and things like that in order to actually, you know, spin out a backstory and, you know, realistic or believable, fun and interesting responses to the game world and the GM and other characters.
So if that sounds interesting, once again, gencon.com/events and search for Total Party Thrill. Join us Saturday, September 18th at 1 p.m.
Also, hey, this is the last technically AP episode. It's not really AP. It's the debrief. But it's over. The hiatus is ending. And in 2 weeks, we will be back to our regular schedule, which means we'll be back to weekly episodes.
This is terrifying.
Yeah, I know. That's going to be a lot of recording.
Yeah.
Okay, crap. Well, we've committed to it on the air now.
What if we go back to, like, you know, maybe every other week we do AP so that we don't have to record so much, Ishan?
Or like 1 week a month? I don't know. Something like, let us know. Shoot us a message. Hop on Discord and let us know what you think. What should we do? I mean, for 6 years, we've been like, we're not an AP show. Come on. There's so many actual plays out there. Why would we do that?
Right. But, you know, maybe we're like an AP sprinkling. After, you know, 6 months, we've tasted the power and now we just got to get more.
It's so much easier to do actual plays. You don't have to write notes.
You don't have to come up with 300 different topics.
Anyway, for now, back to our regular format. Gates of Morning returns, Character Creation Forge returns, and, you know, all your favorite stuff and none of the Tez.
No Tez. No more Tez. No one needs that.
All right, let's hop in. Debrief. Everybody, this is you know, this is what you do at the end of every campaign, right? You're like, oh my God, I loved that. I hated that.
No, you say lose my number.
I never want to talk to you again. Oh yeah, I murdered your character. I didn't think we needed to be friends in real life. So let's kick it off with this then. What are your thoughts on Sunless Citadel without the lens of nostalgia? Because Shane, we picked this in the first place because you had good memories of it from 3.5 D&D. Mm-hmm. I had pretty good memories of it, but neither of us like was intimately familiar with the 5th edition version before we started playing.
For me, it turns out that my nostalgia was mostly for like the very beginning parts of it. And I didn't remember the middle or end. So I was like, I was along for the ride. Like I knew about the vampire tree. Right. And I knew that that was the cause of the twig blights. And I remembered Meepo. And I didn't remember anything in between. So it was kind of like experiencing it all new for me again. But I definitely remember that stupid Mephit before you meet Meepo, and I avoided that idiot.
It's interesting that you remember Meepo so vividly because Meepo is like less than half a page in the actual module because there's barely any characterization. No, he's kind of cowardly. He does this job. And then as soon as you get the dragon back, the kobolds are like, you can keep him if you want. But that's it. He never gets mentioned again because it can't assume you took him.
The reason that, because I'm not the only one here, right? Like, Meepo is a character that, like, lots of people, like, remember. And I think, I honestly think it's one, because the module does sort of telegraph that you can hear crying. And so that immediately, like, sets the encounter differently than everything else in that dungeon, which is open a door and something tries to kill you, or walk through a door, ring a bell, and something comes to try to kill you. I think the fact that his name is Meepo has, like, really, really done a lot of work. Because Meepo is an inherently funny, goofy, but, like, enjoyable name to say. You know?
Yeah, it's,
like,
endearing.
It's my buddy Meepo.
I think it's interesting. I think you're right about this. And I think so many people remember the character because when they played it in 3.5, basically every GM was like, oh, this is great. I'm going to play up this character. I can do a lot with this.
It set itself up in a way that, like, you know, GMs always want to have that NPC you want to talk to, right? And I feel like in those 3.5 days, that wasn't really, certainly at the age I was when I was playing this module, that was not something that my friends were looking for. They were just looking to fight and kill stuff. And so, like, you had this thing where if you were the DM who liked to do that, then you were told this thing is crying. It is really hard to make the leap from it's crying and sobbing. You walk in and it attacks you.
Right.
Right. So you're almost, like, disarmed as the GM. You can't do that. And then also, like, as players, you're, like, disarmed because here's this thing that is, like, obviously miserable and completely innocent, and you're just going to murder them in cold blood. Like, I'm sure groups did that, but, like, lots of groups didn't because it was weird. And you just want to know what happens. And it's named Meepo, for God's sake. So how are you going to kill a Meepo?
I wonder if there was a crossover, because, like, around the same time, I think just a couple of years later, Neverwinter Nights came out, and, like, the expansions included a kobold character that you could take on as a hireling called Deacon. It was kind of the same thing, like, sort of ridiculous and, you know, was a bard and, like, traveling around and, like, writing stories and, like, hung on your every word. Look, if you know Neverwinter Nights and you listen to this actual play, you can tell that I drew a bunch of Deacon into, like, how I ended up sort of characterizing Meepo. But I wonder, like, if it was sort of cyclical, if, like, someone who developed Neverwinter Nights had encountered Meepo, and then other people playing the module just a few years after it came out had already seen Deacon and were like, oh yeah, kobolds are great friends, why not?
And this is one of those things that we could probably, like, track down Bruce Cordell and ask about if we were so inclined. But, like, I wonder if, like, the play experience for a lot of people was also informed by Baldur's Gate.
Mm-hmm.
Baldur's Gate was the first game that really, like, so faithfully adapted D&D rules, but then didn't just make you do D&D fights. Like, it gave you roleplay opportunities that actually influenced the game, like, within the mechanics of D&D. And, like, granted, that was, you know, AD&D, and this was in 3.5, but I just feel like that, like, might have changed incrementally the direction of the game, because it showed that sort of stuff was also possible. You know, I was in that age range where, like, the fun part of D&D was math and fighting, and so, like, any type of contraindication to that was, like, a net gain for my roleplay discovery.
Looking at Sunless Citadel now, it really strikes me that it actually holds up as a pretty straightforward dungeon crawl. You know, mm-hmm. you've got very clear goals. You're in this town. They say, go to this place. There isn't anywhere else to go, nor is there any hook to send you anywhere else.
Right.
You go to the location, you go inside, you clear the first level, you go to the second level, you go to the third level. There's nothing else to do. The rooms all funnel you to a particular destination, so there isn't really a maze to get lost in. And there even are a couple of meaningful RP choices. You can decide to help the kobolds. You could massacre them all. Like, if you're an actual party and you've gotten to, like, level 2, you probably could take all of them. Like, you could kill everything on the entire floor and then go down and take care of Belak. Or, you know, be friends, whatever.
Right.
Or play one against the other, like the goblins against the kobolds or vice versa.
There's a lot of lore baked into Sunless Citadel, and I think that's, like, take it or leave it, right? Like, I think that is one of the things that also holds up really well and makes it really interesting, is that, like, there's a history to the place. It's actually kind of cool to, like, learn about what this dungeon is and what it was and how it got to be that way. So that's one of the things that I do actually remember about it that I think does hold up really well, is, like, it doesn't feel like a generic hole in the ground that you're walking through room by room and clearing out for treasure. It feels like a real lived-in place that you are adventuring through with a purpose. And I just think it does do that really well.
Not everyone really knows that this is actually the first module in an adventure path, kinda, sorta. in 3.5, like it went to Heart of Nightfang Spire. It went to Bastion of Unborn Souls, I think it was.
Didn't it go to Forge of Fury?
That's the next one in Tales of the Yawning Portal. I don't remember if the 3.5 one went that direction. You find out more about Ashardalon, kinda, sorta, a little bit. You find out more about Galthias. I didn't know any of that. This module feels like there are a bunch of names that are dropped and they don't really go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're just playing the 5e version, you're right. They don't lead to anything. So we'll talk about that in a little bit, because that's an interesting challenge slash opportunity for GMs. Another thing that struck me is it's basically like a direct port of the 3.5 module. So it's a direct port of like something written in basically 2000, I think it was. So there are a lot of old school tropes in abundance. The characterization of the goblins is 100% drunken, lazy, and primitive.
It also, like, it has that trope of just sort of ignoring the denizen, like the realism of the denizens. You know, like, it's cool that there's two different groups with two different cultures. Granted, one of those cultures sucks, or sucks in its characterization, but like, it doesn't really explain why they're both there, why they're fighting still, like why this is still unresolved. Like, it definitely never explains how they got this dragon down there.
Yeah.
or why it hasn't tipped the balance of power.
Right. Why doesn't it just murder all of them? There's no explanation.
It is. So it, like, and a lot of that stuff feels like very old school, right? Even though it is, like, you know, a more interesting sort of fridge logic than a lot of times you get in some of those old, like the really old dungeons.
Right. It's not like randomly generated. You know, it's not every time you open a door, there's new stuff in here and it has nothing to do with what's in the next room. But
right.
If you think too deeply about it, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. It has an ecology that is just good enough for fridge logic, I guess, which is an improvement. And I think, like, even in our recording, right, there were points where I was like, as a player, I'm like, how does this make any sense? And you're just kind of like, just go with it.
I had to spin a lot. We'll get to that in terms of like making a coherent storyline out of this.
Sure.
And part of that, I think, is you got all of the lore that's available in the module. You needed some help getting there, because this does that thing where it'll gate some of the lore behind perception checks or secret doors, or it's fine to put treasure there, I guess, you know, if you're not worried about wealth by level. But to put your story behind, like, needing someone to roll a 20 on a perception check is ridiculous.
So this is one of those cases where us being an actual play and, like, having a performance element helped me as a player. Because that stupid dragon priest, the troll dragon priest, like, that room needs a high check to find the history that makes that room worth going to.
There's nothing in that room, that secret door, except the lore.
Right. It's an expensive room to go into because it's hard challenges when you're in there. And then to eat, like, you get nothing for it other than the story. And it was just like, Ishan, give me my freaking story. I came down this path for my story.
If you listen to that part of the AP, like, you're making a check and, you know, we can both tell you that you failed. You can see that we're both coming up for other reasons for you to make more checks, you know,
right?
Like, hoping that you roll high enough. You never get there. So in the end, like we talked about this, I just put the lore in the sarcophagus.
Yeah, this is one of those things where, like, I think trying to adhere to the module kind of undermined play, right? Because like, that definitely needs a fail forward. Like, the, like, you make the check, but the check needs to be for, you know, something above like that baseline lore that makes this place actually interesting, right? Like you said, some treasure or a personal insight or something like that makes sense to gate check that. But like, the history of this dragon priest, like, it cannot be behind a DC 20 check,
because otherwise why in the hell is there a random troll here?
Right. Exactly.
That's a good segue into talking about what we changed and what we added to the module. We changed a fair amount, especially on the tail end. The original plan was, you know, we're on hiatus. We're trying not to do too much work with two babies. So let's just run a pre-written module. And so mostly I'm just reading the box text.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and only then after we play a few, was I like, okay, no, some of this doesn't make any sense. some of this needs to be more interesting. We suck at an Eberron, so let's sort of start switching things up.
Yeah, we got a brand to maintain here, okay? Right.
So the first thing that changed is I connected this town to the Citadel, right? I think it's Oakhurst is the name of the actual town in the module. We called it Mistmarsh a town in Breland. But there's no connection to the Sunless Citadel. There's no history connection whatsoever. Why does it exist here? Why has only this one adventuring party gone there? There's no explanation. And that didn't really make sense to funnel you in there, especially when Tez is a character who is interested in history and lore and secrets and things like that, you know?
That is one of those fridge logic moments of like, how did these level two adventurers find this place, hear about this place, think that they were strong enough to go down there, fight their way through kobolds and goblins to then get to the, like, the outcast? Like, it just, like, yeah, sure, you're following another adventuring party, but, like, why aren't there dozens of adventuring parties who've gone to this place if it's common knowledge? And if it's not common knowledge, how did they find out about it, and why has nobody gone looking for them? Like, it's just, it's a little bit goofy.
How is it not ransacked for 2,000 years, and the only thing guarding it is rats?
Right, exactly.
So, you know, it made more sense to, like, have there be a festival and, you know, explain that the goblins show up for some reason and they must be coming from somewhere, and old Garen has heard stories. And, you know, that gives us more characterization and also points the characters very much in the direction of the Citadel and actually be interested in going there.
You made up, like, all the NPCs in town, right?
There are names and there are races and there are genders. That's basically it. But yeah, I mean, every personality of every NPC I had to make up either on the fly, because I was like, oh crap, you're gonna visit the priest, all right let's figure out what Corky Knackle is like. And then, you know, Meepo obviously whole cloth, and Erky Timbers is an entire fabrication. Nothing Erky Timbers does in our actual play has anything to do with the module. He's in a cage. He's obviously there so that if you don't have a healer in your party, he can join the party and, like, just spit out cure wounds, and that's it. But there's no information about him whatsoever.
There's no reason that he would be down there. There's no reason the kobold wouldn't know who he was. There's no reason that the goblins would have him and keep him. It literally, like, he is just floating out there on an island.
There's no reason why he has 17 hit points and 5 hit dice.
Yeah.
I also standardized, like, the perception or investigation checks for traps. I don't know if this was, like, a relic of early 5th edition, but the module will sort of, like, toggle willy-nilly between this trap takes a perception check to find, or this trap takes an investigation check to find, or whatever, and it hardly ever calls out either or. And I was just like, all right, investigation is for traps and perception is for, like, noticing stuff, okay? So, and then I would just, after a while, I was just like, I'm going to stop saying what the module says, and I will just call for the thing that we have established.
Right, yeah.
And then also, so you can be like, I make a perception check, right? And then, you know, early on I had to be like, can you also make an investigation check?
And then you get tired and you go, perception or investigation, whichever one you feel like rolling. They're both plus two.
I mean, you're looking around carefully, right? All right, cool. I also did that with the light. You had dark vision, so it didn't really matter that much. There is technically a -5 to your passive perception penalty, and also disadvantage if you're in dim light on perception. But I was just like, I'll apply it when necessary. And if you need to look at stuff, we're assuming you light a torch, and then you put out a torch, and then you light a torch, whatever.
That would have been very annoying in 5th edition, or in 3rd edition too. I'm sure that's a standard -5 penalty. That's just, one, doesn't exist in 5th edition. Like, we don't do that anymore, right? Like, you just have disadvantage now.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, disadvantage in the end, -5 to your passive perception.
Right.
But it's all really annoying. And then some characters get it and some characters don't. Fortunately, all of you had dark vision.
You also did me a huge favor, because I had the map and I still got lost without having, like, you know, tokens or something to represent what room we're actually in. I really appreciated that sometimes you just streamlined sections of the dungeon and were like, you can make a left or a right. Great. Or like,
this says there are two more doors. It doesn't matter. There's nothing in there.
Oh, so, right.
Yeah. They-
I think that made for a better show, and it definitely made me a lot less frustrated as a player wandering around lost, wondering if there's anything in this old broom closet.
And that is one benefit of D&D Beyond, is there are player versions of all the maps. So I was just like, here's the link. You can look at it. You can, oh, where are you? The swirly bit up on the left.
Cool. Yeah, exactly.
I did eventually start taking time to tie the disparate elements that are present in this story and the lore into something kind of coherent. I love lore, and that's almost the most important thing to me. And like, in order to have an interesting actual play, I feel like all of the tidbits that Tez was picking up, it wouldn't make any sense, or it would be sort of like deflating in the end for those to go nowhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, even like the name of Shardalon is like behind that one goblin, and you have to pull the spear out and like look behind the body. But if you don't do that, then you'd never find out that this is a cult of a Shardalon.
Right.
There's a Quasit. Why the heck is there a Quasit here? Well, we know it's because it's just a random thing from the monster manual. it had no tie to like a Shardalon and him sticking a Baelor in his chest. So, you know, put those two things together. Why is there a troll here? It's because they picked a troll out of the monster manual and they're like, we need to have an excuse for it to be here. So it used to be a dragon priest and it turned itself into a troll.
Right.
Calcerix, why is the dragon here? Like you said, no explanation. So I had to give a reason why Calcerix was here. And then the Golthias tree, you know, a vampire was killed. But like, why is the vampire here? No explanation.
The Golthias tree history, I don't know if we actually touched on it in the actual play, but it's like it grew like it was a vampire Golthias who was staked with like a living sapling. Right. And then the sapling grew. And
then like his soul inhabits the tree.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Which I think is actually really cool. And I'm sure like if you follow the adventure path, that maybe goes somewhere. So I do think that's a cool element. It doesn't really come out very well because there's no history of Golthias in the module, right? Mm-hmm. Or at least not in the like not to be found by players anywhere. So it's like a little bit goofy.
In case you hadn't guessed, the entire epilogue of Tez going and getting his diploma and the thesis defense was obviously completely made up and doesn't exist in the module in any capacity.
Yeah, as was everything with Skellebro. That was my interjection. Like the night of, I was like, hey, I'm declaring this to be true because it's cool. Let me do it. And you were like, oh, that's a great idea to put into like the next adventure. And I was like, no.
I want it now and we'll fix it in flashbacks.
Exactly.
All right. All right.
Give me Skellebro as an actual sidekick. You took away Erky.
Right. You made him turn on me and I need something else. Sure. I mean, it's certainly not going to hurt the balance.
Right.
I got to come up with a voice, but whatever. And then like a lot of things that we changed had to do with us porting it over to Eberron. And I think grounding in Eberron was such a good idea.
It added to the sense of weird because there's so much history to Eberron. And I think like, I think you just took the timing that was like straight out of the module of like, this place is 2000 years old. And like, when you read that out loud and I go, wait a minute, that predates modern Corvair. Like, and it's like, you got a week to figure out why.
I always want to GM now 1 hour at a time because I always have like a week or two to be like, oh, man, okay, what happens next? And why the heck did this happen?
You should never go to inform you that a lot of those episodes were like 2 hours at a time, but
yeah, okay, but not four or six.
True.
We did have to switch up the characterization of the monster races. Like you just can't have lazy drunken goblins in Eberron, or like it actually comes across as racist.
That's one of the parts of Eberron that I like, is like the Dakani history, right? Mm-hmm. And so like, I mean, I like it, so you know, it's history, so I just gave Tez that knowledge, which probably was too rare to really give to just, you know, a student. But I really liked that aspect of like appealing to their, like, you know, their sense of self and like wondering why is this colony here and why is it still here? So like, how has it been here for so long, like isolated from the rest of the empire? That's something that I actually, if we do another episode or like another series, like I would love to spend time figuring that out. I think that's actually like actually cooler than like further excavating like the Sunken Citadel or I think that, don't they call it the Sunken Citadel when people refer to it in the module too?
Sometimes, yes. Yeah. Speaking of knowledge that Tez shouldn't have, he probably wouldn't know about the chamber.
The chamber,
so
yeah.
We're going to need to figure out how he knows about the chamber and how the chamber feels about him talking in front of all these people about the chamber.
Yeah.
You were doing it and I was like, I could tell him he doesn't know that, but no, this is more interesting. Let's just do it.
Oops. Problem is, I've played in Eberron too long.
Right. Well, speaking of which, elves and dragons, like, I'm pretty sure you mentioned this to me. I don't remember if it was even on air, but you were like, what are you talking about, elves who, like, are part of a dragon cult? That doesn't make any sense, given Eberron. Like, they hate each other. So I had to, like, come up with a reason that there's an elven cult of, like, this dragon anyway.
Yeah, right. It was, oops.
All the tech, there's no, like, tech stuff in the module, right? So all the artifice, the stasis fields, like none of that exists, right? So we sort of shoved that in there with artifice, plus there was a gnome, so what else are you going to do?
How much of like the laboratory and stuff did you actually make up, and how much of that was just in there and it was like, oh, this is just Eberron stuff?
It's pretty much all made up. The laboratory, I think, had like alchemical agents, and it did have that giant rat with the potion that basically like diseased it.
Mm-hmm.
There were some goblins in there basically working with fungus, but all the like mechanical apparatus, the stasis field, the Mabar and energy, all of that was like me giving a reason that other stuff that shows up in the module is actually here.
And I think that combined with like Belak's study, which again, don't know how much you recharacterize that, but like I think that does give like a lot of sense of Eberron, is that like even a villain who is a druid who is just like sending these twig blights into the world, there's an element of like science and exploration and documentation to that that like doesn't feel medieval fantasy at all.
Mm-hmm.
Belak is like a really weird druid because like he's a scholar, which means he's highly educated. Like if he's making that many notes, you know, like that's not super common in traditional fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
Bringing that into Eberron though, it's just like, oh, he's like sort of a mad scientist, right? Like in his own right, which is very Eberron.
Right. Like suddenly everyone is using the scientific method and no one's questioning why you would do that. They're like, oh, of course right. He's keeping notes. Oh, this is iteration one. Yeah, I get it.
He's got crop rotations. Of course he does.
Of course he does. And then, you know, Erky, all of that with the trust, obviously. And Erky being, well, a character who was interesting in any capacity was made from whole cloth.
So mad. I'm so mad about that. I'm so mad.
Well, I needed an explanation because, like, you have his sheet and he has the most hit points and he's a second level character with 5 hit dice, but only first level spells. Like, and I was just like, I mean, like maybe he's a half caster. That explains it, right? Maybe he's way higher level than this and he's holding back. Okay. Yep. Erky's a plant. Got it.
I want to clarify that you needed to explain that for you. You did not need to explain that for me. I was perfectly happy with my buddy Erky, okay? You ruined a good thing, Ishan.
You're going to love him. You're going to love him as 004 or whatever he's going to be.
For every Erky you lose along the way, you find a Scalabro, though.
When the GM kills an Erky, they open a Scalabro. A rib cage or something. All right, so let's talk about doing this in terms of solo play, because obviously this is not a module written for that. Mm-hmm. I think this is our first time doing solo play. Is it for you?
I think it's my first time playing solo D&D. Mm-hmm. I've played some other games solo that were allegedly designed for it. We haven't talked about Knights Black Agents 1-to-1, like solo ops, but I played that with my mom and found that to be very frustrating. Mm-hmm. I was like, I see what's going on with this now, and I don't like it, and we're going to continue this with Knights Black Agents.
Is it because it was too easy for your mom? She's just no-scoping everything?
No, it's that there was a fear of improv, inherent in the game setup and design. And like, so it's very like card and like physical tool driven, which means it's highly prep driven, which just felt weird to me when I was like, the best part about solo play is that you only have to improv for one person.
Like, and the best part about Knights Black Agents is you don't have to plan anything.
Yeah, exactly. So like, it didn't feel necessary. So that, yeah, I mean, I don't think I've played solo D&D. I've never been a solo player anyway.
I think this offered a lot of benefits. I mean, I had to prep a lot less. I prepped almost none.
Mm-hmm.
But I could prep a lot less because I didn't need to worry about too many different storylines. And Tez could just explore however much he wanted and take as much time as he wanted. I didn't need to worry about giving him too much spotlight because he gets the entire spotlight.
Right.
And I didn't need to worry about, like, if you're like, okay, I spend an hour copying these frescoes, that doesn't matter. And I don't need to fill that time for the other characters.
Right.
And here, yeah. And no one else needs to be like, well, either I do something else and that takes up too much game time, or let's hand wave that and just say everyone stands around.
We never had to ask what you're doing. From a story, show, entertainment perspective, I think that is distracting. Hey, fill in the time.
Mm-hmm.
But the protagonist thing that's happening right now is like making these notes, right? And of course, like if you make the notes, they have to be relevant somehow. And so that then becomes the challenge, right? Of like all these activities that you're doing, that you're like asking everyone around the table, like, how do you spend this time? If you aren't just opting out of the time, then you've got to make them like, it just, it does lead to a lot of stuff. Like it just adds friction to every, like every momentum swing, you know, like every like action beat, like it adds friction to.
Right.
So I really enjoyed that. Like, and I really liked being able to explore the dungeon in the way that I wanted. That was most interesting to me. I hope you tracked my interest though, because otherwise that must have been excruciating to be focused on these silly dragon and elf cults instead of like, you know, beating up goblins or whatever you wanted me to be doing.
Well, it was a nice thing about using a pre-made module and then tweaking it is you had a character who went in and said, my character's interested in these things. And I was like, great, I'm ignoring everything else.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't need to make up anything that you won't be interested in. And you focused on basically two skills. So let's just do all that stuff. You know?
Yeah, two skills, fighting and fighting.
5e has really long combats. This was much faster with just one other player. It was still slow.
It was.
Partially because of the sidekicks, but much faster because you were in charge of all of them. And so you were just like, okay, they do this, 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 and this, done.
And we could talk about sidekicks in general. But I think the problem that comes with solo combat is having to keep in mind all the abilities that are available to me and then having to react as like each, as the situation continues to change with each thing that the enemies do, right? So it's one person having to track three things. Or three sets of abilities, which is difficult. It's nice because I don't have to gain any consensus or agreement on what we're going to be doing, right? I don't have to like negotiate with people to plan things, but I still have to keep all that in my head. And a lot of times, like I miss stuff, I misread stuff. You know, like I just like overlooked things on my sheet, or I fell into like a routine rather than like necessarily being able to like, what would Tez do in this situation? And part of that is because, like, we have a need to keep combat moving, and doing something right now is more important to, like, flowing through combat than doing, like, the perfect thing. My thought of taking a rogue in the first place was that I would do a lot of, like, engaging, hiding, retreating, trapping, and sabotaging, make each fight really long, but make it really, like, strung out over time and space so that I would be safe. And then by adding the sidekicks back in, that went out the window. You can't do that if you have teammates.
Right. Suddenly, like, they don't have stealth capabilities.
Right. Yeah. So Meepo and Ricky die every fight, and Tez fights for 3 hours straight, like, hunting these four goblins. Right. Who's...
Now, there was the option. I think it wouldn't have made for really good actual play, but there would have been the option to, like, sort of leave them behind, like you might do in a video game. Tez stealths ahead, kills everything slowly, and then they come along.
Right.
But, I mean, that's kind of like the optimizer version.
Yeah, and it also is hard to do. I mean, if the module isn't specifically set up to allow that, like, it's very hard to actually do that.
Right, especially with wandering monsters.
Yeah.
I will say, you know, when we started talking about doing a one-on-one game, like, I definitely wouldn't do this as, like, a pickup game or even someone that I knew casually. We have been gaming together for, what, like, 8 years now?
Mm-hmm.
I know how you play, you know how I play, I know how you run a game, you know how I run a game. And we still did a lot of like above the table talk, either like beforehand or like some of that got cut out and some of it we left in the episode to like figure out how we were gonna play this so that it would go smoothly.
But I think a lot of that was because we know we're playing for an audience, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's about making sure that we have an entertaining product for the audience rather than just like the game that you and I would enjoy playing just the two of us. We probably could have like fumbled through it with some ongoing above the table discussion rather than doing any like kind of organizing and planning in advance, just because if we were our only audience, who would know?
Well, you know, I didn't open up the gates of hell and have you start fighting wave after wave of demon, which I think would have been really interesting.
Yet.
Yeah, that's true. It's a good point. It's an excellent point.
So let's talk about some other stuff that we would do differently.
Part of the reason that we did this is so that it wouldn't take too much effort, but I would plan from the jump. Read the entire module before we actually start playing it. I read like section one. I was like, all right, let's play this. And then, you know, each time I was like, okay, I got to read the rest of the module. But I ended up getting locked into some things early on that I wasn't in. Like, I didn't want to play out later, but I was like, well, there's no way that I can get out of this. So here we are, and let's just go with it.
Like what?
Some of the characterization of the the NPCs back at town, I think, could have been more interesting or less interesting, right? Like, there were just a lot of them right at the beginning, mm-hmm. and all kind of like sort of saying the same thing, which is what the module says, is here's the information that you can get from everybody. Most people know the same stuff.
Right.
You know, they could have been more differentiated. And then I was left later being like, is that a loose end that we have to tie up? Do you need to go talk to the mayor? Does the mayor do something different? Or is he just going to say the same thing that Carowyn is going to say?
Zero chance that Tez was going to go talk to that mayor again. That guy was an idiot.
Would you have played a different class? Because we had talked about that at the beginning. You picked Rogue because it would play well on an AP.
I wouldn't. I mean, I really like Tez, and I guess spoiler alert for level 4 is I'm going to pick up some Artificer as well. Yeah. So it'll be kind of a Rogue Artificer. I like the idea of a stealthy Rogue in power armor. So we're headed that direction. I'm happy with the choice I made. I mean, the biggest choice, or the most kind of difficult choice, was when I hit level 3.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not I go for Thief, which felt very Tez, or Swashbuckler, which could also be Tez, mm-hmm. but is way stronger as a solo.
Yeah.
Purely solo, being able to proc your own sneak attack every round is, like, priceless.
Which works for a pirate from the Lazar Principalities.
It does, and it would have been fine, but I wanted to mix it up and play Thief because I've never played Thief. I have played Swashbuckler, and every time I use any rogue, like, you know, I'm looking for that. So I just, you know, it feels like Swashbuckler is such like a, like Swashbuckler and Assassin are such staple rogues that I felt like maybe it would be better to showcase something different for the show. I don't regret it, but that is probably the area that I spent the most time hemming and hawing over.
I mean, and I love Thief, and I love the abilities of the Thief, and they did come in useful, so I'm glad you ended up taking it.
They did, except that I don't have any casting, so I can't use scrolls yet, and I don't have use magical device because it's level 13.
Yeah,
that part of it, that when I like looked at it and I realized that like all I can do is take potions, I was like, this actually is like really stupid
to keep yourself alive.
Sure, but like,
if you care about that,
not when you get one shot by stuff.
Yeah. So I think we might differ on sidekicks. You're not a fan of sidekicks.
I hate sidekicks. They might work better when they're an NPC that's shared by the group, right? Like, so if you have one sidekick for a group of four, like, sure, I think these rules make some sense and the sheet is fine. They're a big pain in the ass for solo, especially when you have a couple of them, which is kind of what you need if you're not tailoring a module for solo play. They have lots of abilities. They're just as fiddly. The math is annoying. And I mean, frankly, D&D Beyond doesn't have great support for it.
It's basically no support.
Yeah.
You had to write their sheets in a Google Doc.
So I'm only keeping track of like the most important bits. And then also like the idea that anybody can be a sidekick, but they get filtered into three classes. And if you don't happen to have the stat useful for that class, they're useless. Hey, it's a kobold. Kobolds are supposed to be sorcerers, right? Like, they're draconic. Draconic sorcerer. That's a thing, right? So I was like, cool, you're a sorcerer now. And it's like, haha, joke's on you. You should have picked the rogue version so he could have done something useful with his decks. Like, the rules suck. The rule just sucks for that. And, like, it doesn't have the flexibility to, like, fix the game world logic to match the character sheet. Because, like, Meepo absolutely should be a sorcerer.
Or a ranger.
Yeah, he'd be fine as a rogue or a ranger. Like, either one of those would be fine. But, like, the fact that, like, just by default, he doesn't have charisma, therefore he can't be a charisma caster, therefore there's no kobold sorcerer sidekicks. This is not useful. Like, that it's just restrictive.
It does put, like, a PC ability template on top of NPC stats. And those are, or monster stats, really.
They don't really feel like a sidekick when you're playing with them. They feel like another PC. They don't have all the abilities of a PC, but they have 85% of the abilities of a PC at low level, because PCs don't have that many options. So, like, I got to play three characters now, except two of them are kind of shitty, and one of them is me. And then I got to share the responsibility, right? That doesn't feel like a sidekick to me if I got to fiddle with all of their mechanics and sheets and stuff. Now I'm spending just as much time playing them as I am playing me. Mm-hmm. To me, a sidekick, like, narratively in, like, the fiction, the sidekick shows up, does the thing that, like, unlocks the situation or resets the balance or changes the fight, and then disappears again because they're a sidekick.
Like, they don't take the spotlight and get all the, like, headshot kills and become, like, you know, the, like, the head knocker, right? Like, that's not a sidekick. That's another protagonist. I love Meepo, but, like, that's not a sidekick.
Someone's jealous of Meepo. Perfect.
I'm not. I mean, I think it's, so I actually think it's really cool. If I were creating a sidekick, like, I would treat it like a legendary action or something like that, where it's, like, once per round or once per fight, like, Meepo does his thing, which is use the head knocker, right? Like, knock somebody off their feet. Erky blesses you once per round or once per fight and, like, resets your hit points or something. This whole thing where I gotta manage their placement and their positioning and, like, are they getting flanked and are they gonna die and do I have to spend my actions to get my sidekick back up and, like, all this stuff, like, does that feel like solo adventure to you? No, it feels like small group adventure. It's just a different thing.
It does bring up the question as to, like, where sidekicks, like, what kind of game sidekicks really fit in? Because there's this tension in solo play. It was useful for me for you to have a bigger party.
Sure.
Because it meant that I had to change less of the module. I didn't have to, like, reduce the difficulty that much or in the end at all, really. Not because the sidekicks are so powerful, but because in a lot of ways they're damage sponges.
Right. Yes, exactly. They're ablative armor for Tez's hit points.
A massive amount of armor, because as soon as they become NPCs or sidekicks, suddenly they get death saving throws, which right. means they basically have maybe five times the hit points effectively.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you can, you know, choose to get them back up. And with one as a healer, well, two as healers actually, then it's
right.
not difficult.
One is a good healer.
Okay, so if it works in some capacity in solo play, but takes away from the aspect of solo play that you actually want, it doesn't really work in a big group either, because it would be a nightmare for a party of four to each have their own sidekick.
Yeah, I definitely wouldn't say that you'd each have your own sidekick. I would think it would be like a group sidekick that takes one action to benefit the group each round.
If you could do that, certainly. Now, if you run the module as written, you go in with four characters, between four and six characters, and then you come out with two additional sidekicks, and that's way too many, especially if anyone has summons or pets or familiars or anything like that.
Yeah, totally. No. And I get that this is, like, the sidekick rules are written for D&D to fit them into fiddly D&D combat, right? And I find it frustrating they're called sidekicks, because to me, they're NPC companions. This is where, like, the kind of game and simulation of D&D, like, meets the storytelling of D&D, and I think it falls down a little bit for what I would be looking for. And how I would envision it, but, like, hey, to each his own, right? Like, I can go write a series of sidekick feats if I wanted to empower characters with sidekick abilities that are just kind of just off screen at any moment until they show up.
It's nice that the option exists in the game. It is obviously an afterthought in terms of the way it was implemented.
It is an efficiently implemented afterthought.
All right, so let's talk about actual plays of format, because this is, like, our first time on this podcast doing an actual play, mainly because we have poo-pooed it for so long.
Indeed. So we did do Stream of Blades, right? And we've participated in some streamed games. And so this is definitely a different experience. I think like the pre-record versus live play aspect is I cannot speak enough about the luxury that editing provides.
Oh, absolutely.
I don't think we could have done this before we had a ROM editing. I don't think either of us could have made this anything close to what it was, anywhere near as entertaining. I don't think we would have enjoyed listening to our own work as much as we did if we hadn't had a ROM doing the soundscaping, letting us do retakes, killing all the dead air, like editing out our rules lookups. Like, just all of that stuff was really helpful.
Longtime listeners know that for most of the life of the show, we edited our own episodes. And it's only recently, since the pandemic, that we brought a ROM on to do that. Even on our own, knowing how to edit, it would not have looked or sounded anything like this. Like, you, when you listen back to your own game, you're like, this sounds way better than we actually played it out. What are you talking about? It's because the dead air got cut. You can tell that, like, a line gets dropped, and then the music swells and there's a long pause, much longer than we actually had in real life. And then the action kicks in. Like, it is excellent timing and pacing.
He added a ton of gravity and drama to a lot of moments. The Skelebro moment when he appears, like, is this, like, burning beacon to turn the tide of the fight, right? Like a sidekick should. Like to burn the tree. Like what Aram did with that editing was completely without our direction, right? He just listened to it, was like, nope, this is the moment. We got to play this up. Here's how you do it. I know how to do that. I'm a competent editor. And I'm like, great. Thank God we have him.
We give him no direction on the audio. Okay. Just let's make that clear. That is not us.
Yeah, all we do is tell him where the files are and what we screwed up that needed to be re-recorded so he could piece it together in case we noticed.
I think we dropped 3 F-bombs. Please try to get those.
Exactly. The other thing, though, is like pacing is important, but it's also differently important between like a podcast and like a live stream. Like in Stream of Blades, which, you know, I feel like I had a lot of the pacing responsibility as like the GM for that game. Like, because we had to like end each session on time. We had to end it on the right beat, right? We didn't want it to just go out. Like, it couldn't be a cliffhanger, but then it also like wasn't going to be like just kind of like, okay, well, we're at time, so guess we'll just pick up next week. You know, like it had to have like, it had to have some forward drive to it, but then like, you know, you also have to manage the dead air. Like, you've got to either fill or vamp or like give people time to think. And it's just like, it was a lot more managing performance as part of like live streaming that we just didn't have to do with Sunless Citadel.
We know when there's going to be an edit to take out dead air. And so you're just very quiet while someone's thinking.
Make it really easy for Aram to find the dead air.
Yeah. I do think, though, like having to have something interesting happen every hour is something that I might take into my like live games. You know, we always talk about one shots, like a 4-hour session is 3 hours in an ending. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's also good to have a tonal shift or something happen to move things along, to prod them forward every hour in there. And I think that's something I'll probably just keep in mind in the future.
Yeah, I think you did a good job, intentionally or otherwise, of like balancing like the pacing between like, is this episode driven by combat? Is this driven by role play? Is this driven by like advancing the story, right? Or like, and by story, I mean like generally like the overarching story of like the world. I guess the history, really. But like, it felt like every episode you like, we drove one of those things forward, right? And so like, I think, I don't know. I haven't listened to the whole thing like straight through to like, maybe we missed for an hour, but like, I feel like that's what we were aiming for, right? Is like each episode had to at least accomplish one of those things in an interesting way, or else it was kind of like would fall flat.
Using a classic module like Sunless Citadel helped with that. I don't even necessarily know that it was intentional in terms of the module, but because it is old school, it does mostly adhere to the general tropes of an interesting thing will happen every few rooms, just because that is what propels the dungeon crawl.
Yeah, but you didn't make me slog through a couple rooms to get an interesting reward, right? You just paced that out according to what we needed for where we were in our recording of the time, you know? Like, hey, if we're at 30 minutes, like, I don't want to go through two dull rooms to get to the third interesting one. Like, I'm going to summarize two dull rooms and tell you what's in the third.
I'm a huge fan, and that's easier in solo play, right? To just be like, here's what you saw, and I know you're not interested in that, rather than three other people being like, well, maybe I was interested.
Yeah, exactly. No, you weren't. Shut up.
No one was. They're dull rooms. It says here, right in the module. Yeah,
empty, bare cupboard.
The digital tools helped a lot. It was nice to just run this thing straight out of D&D Beyond. I just read the box text off my screen.
I don't think putting together an AP without digital tools, especially remotely, makes nearly as much sense. Not having to flip through books, right? Like, I mean, for Stream of Blades, like, literally would have been impossible to manage the sheets that are necessary for Band of Blades without Roll20 integration. Like, Roll20 was our character repository. Without that, it would have been impossible.
Absolutely.
On the character side, like, on the player side, like, having the character sheet, having, like, clickable reference, like, being able to quickly add and drop items and spells, like, the biggest concern was that my like typing on the keyboard to like bring those things up was going to like corrupt the audio. But after I got over that and Aram's editing took that out, like it was great because it just put everything at our fingertips and no like, wait, which book is that spell in? Like flip to the S's, you know, like figure this out. Look these two things up side by side. It was just like very easy.
Right. No post-it notes or anything. Like at the beginning, before we recorded, I would simply open D&D Beyond, go to the part in the adventure that we were starting at, and then I knew approximately what we were going to be able to get through. So just in different tabs, I opened up all the monster stat blocks for everything you might possibly encounter, or scrolls, or whatever. So I just need to flick between the different tabs once you're like, okay, what does that do? Of course, absolutely no current support for sidekicks. Maybe that'll come in the future, which will make that a lot easier.
Yeah.
Because you could just have three tabs with everyone's abilities.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could add them as a monster stat block or something, but like yeah. That isn't super intuitive in D&D Beyond. Like, it's doable, it's not unmanageable, but like it gets into the same problem that like the Artificer pets got into, where it was mm-hmm. like I had to learn D&D Beyond like markup code in order to like make it work, and it was just annoying.
Yeah, I was thinking about doing that for Skelebro now that Skelebro is going to be a sidekick, but I was like, I need to like create a homebrew monster, and every time anything changes, I need to edit the monster.
Yeah, exactly. But I will say, I really like the one-on-one format for actual play. Like, I found it very easy. Obviously, I know our voices, but to keep track of two voices rather than like four or mm-hmm. five or like, God help, six voices in a show drives me insane. I really liked that it was just the two of us. Like, that made it very easy to listen to, and then also very easy to like align on our schedules, because we could just, hey, it's 11 o'clock on a Tuesday, we're recording now.
Yeah.
It was also like you said, like we knew what our interests were. We kind of knew the direction we liked. We knew the themes that we were each picking up on, and we were able to just lean into it without having to like build any consensus or get any agreement. I think that helped the show move quickly and like move coherently. One thing that takes me out of actual play is like when there's the one person who's premise rejecting, or the one person who's like,
that's you. What are you talking about? You're the one premise rejecting.
But when I'm the only one, it's perfect. That is the rejection is the premise. But you have that one person who's like pulling on a thread adjacent or a tangent, and it's like, no, the cool story's over there. That's what everyone's driving towards. Get on board, dude. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. stop. Like, who cares about this little thing from your backstory right now? We're not focused on that. Move on.
Yeah. It was nice to never have a time when like someone wasn't paying attention, because it's just us.
Yeah, that is one thing, is that you have to be on the whole time. I finished a lot more tired than I usually do from playing role-playing games.
One-on-one also did make it like a treat, like a special occasion to have on Aram as our guest for the finale.
I did not expect, by the way. I mean, I knew that Aram was going to be like joining, and I figured Aram would play an Aram character, you know, like a lot of gravitas and sort of inscrutable. But I did not expect Flamewind. That was like, and I don't even remember if this made it into the final cut, but like, you said Flamewind, and I was like, wait a minute. Isn't Flamewind like a named character from the book? Like, hang on. Like, Flamewind? Like,
I gave him some notes, and he ran with them. It was great. The finale, since it had absolutely nothing to do with the module, was the thing that I spent actually the most time on prepping. I don't know if this occurred to you. It's basically the same mechanics as the Angel Trial in the original Morning Glory campaign.
I absolutely picked up on that, and I absolutely did the same thing of not preparing anything and just winging it. So
I assumed you would do that. I also did too, and I think it worked out fine. And then sometimes I was just like, I don't know, Aram, what do?
Talking about that a little bit, because you didn't share the format beforehand, and I didn't really know what I was preparing for that episode.
Oh, I told Aram the format beforehand because I knew that he wouldn't optimize a character to break those rules given a week.
I wouldn't have done that either. The thing is, like, so here was my fear as we were recording that, was that like, and this actually goes into one of the challenges of like one-to-one and one-to-one for actual play, is like, it was totally dependent on my spontaneous creativity at 11 o'clock on a Tuesday around a bunch of history that we had like accumulated over 6 months, where I didn't take a lot of notes. Like, I didn't have a lot of detailed notes about it, right? And so it was like, start your thesis. And I was like, what is my thesis? So I guess I'll just start recapping some weird stuff we learned. And you're like, cool, you're going full conspiracy theory. And I was like, I guess I am, because that's all I remember, Ishan. You didn't give me time to prepare this. So I guess that's what Tez does. He shoots a shot.
Which is exactly what I think Tez as a grad student would have done. Woken up and be like, wait, what is my thesis?
But Tez, Tez is prepared, right? That's what makes Tez. I think that's what I was going for with Tez, is that he is a hard worker because he's not brilliant, but he's like quick to get in over his head, and then he improvises and figures it out. He'll get punched in the jaw, but then he'll get back up and through some clever way, like, get himself out of it. Like, that's the Tez that I was, like, kind of thinking of. And that's sort of what happened in that as well, right? But I think the being completely unprepared versus being completely overwhelmed, like, I think I would have preferred Tez come off as overwhelmed. And maybe to a degree, hey, it's Flamewind. Maybe he was. Mm. But like to a degree, like as a player, like I felt like I should have been more prepared to represent Tez better, which was a bit of a challenge. But like, again, like that's the sort of the nature of like, I think some of the fun of actual play is like dropping that surprise on the player and then like getting the, as the audience, you get that sort of like meta sense of like, oh, Shane is really struggling right now, right? That's entertaining to watch somebody squirming, but at the same time, like getting a story that's actually like entertaining and interesting out of it. So I think we walked that line a little bit. It isn't exactly what I would have preferred as a performer, but I definitely enjoyed the episode with just doing what I usually do in these moments, which is show up unprepared and wing it.
Actual play, I think, is excellent practice for just regular GMing and like regular play. You're thrown into it, you can't pause or stop because you know you need to keep everything moving. And I think we have talked a lot in the past about emergent character backgrounds, right? Mm-hmm. Those are like, you sort of come with a character who doesn't really have a particularly defined background, or like there's one thing you know about them, and then as you play you sort of figure out additional things about them, or you add that to your character and you say, oh, actually this is true about them, and that helps you really tie it into the story, as opposed to showing up with like a 4-page document about their backstory and then the GM has to work that in.
Yeah, Tez's backstory was like 3 high concept ideas,
right?
and like an urgent problem, which is he needs money for tuition.
And now it's not bad to show up with that much information. Like, a GM can find that helpful, but emergent role play works really well in these kinds of situations too, where like, I didn't know what the characterization of a random NPC in the town was going to be, but like, we talk, that person talks with Tez for 10 minutes and like, now they have a personality and like, okay, great, that's what it's going to be now, you know?
There was one of those moments for Tez too, when he threw up after killing the hobgoblins, I didn't go into it expecting him to do that, and I was even like canonically wrong that it wasn't the first time he'd killed somebody. Like, as much as he likes to see himself as like hardened, he's killed a bunch of rats. You know, like, he hasn't killed a person yet. Like, he's destroyed dead things, you know, like, and now he's actually killing a person, admittedly a bad one, but like, a hobgoblin is a person,
and as an Eberron character, like, it would mean something to Tez, you know?
Right.
And I think that's not a character choice that you would have made about Tez in episode 1.
Certainly not. In episode 1, my sort of inspiration for Tez was Dr. Aphra. The only reason she doesn't come off as a complete murderous psychopath is the fact that her 2 droids are actual murderous psychopaths. She's the least psychopathic murderer of the 3 of them.
You can also hear this in like even my characterization of voices, you know, starting with a voice and just, you know, it wobbles a bit until I'm like, all right, I think that one's different enough from another voice. And that's a voice I can do long term and that I can probably remember. And then they come up 3 weeks later and I'm like, crap, what was their voice again? Let's just go with it and we'll see.
Yeah. some character drift.
Yeah.
Some recasting in the moment.
AP is great practice to make you like force you to commit to choices and then just go with them and spin out an interesting tale and character.
We are running long on time, Ishan, so why don't we draw some sort of conclusion here? Would you play Sunless Citadel again?
I would probably run it for people, especially newbies, because it is so straightforward and introduces you to so many of the tropes. I would switch a lot of things up because some of the tropes don't actually make any sense if you're not familiar with D&D. I think it's ruined for me in terms of playing it as a character because I know it all now. It would have to be completely different. But like, I would do this, this scenario, this, actual play thing that we did. I would do that again, certainly.
Yeah, same. I don't think I would play Sunless Citadel again. I think I've been through it enough now, but I think I would run it, sort of similar to the way that like you ran it.
Like, I like some of the themes that you tied together. So I think I would be interested in running that for new players. I think it's a fine module. Mm. Not great. Certainly not the best. Obviously has some shortcomings that can, you know, be reworked. But I would definitely run it again.
Would you play a solo D&D game again?
Yeah, I would. I mean, I would do another actual play. I would actually love to do more. If that's something that our listeners like, I'd absolutely be down for that. I really like the format. I really like the solo format for actual play. In terms of running just a solo game, I think I would for the right people, right? Like, I could definitely, like, family members, somebody like that, you know, where, like, we don't have a group. We don't really have, like, a regular, like, sort of schedule, but, like, I'd like to, like, share this hobby and activity. Like, I think that's a great format for it, or, like, one or two people. Honestly, like, I don't know that I would just play a solo adventure with you if we weren't recording it for an actual play, because it is still a lot of time. It is still a lot of work. And, like, if it weren't for the audience, I don't know that I would get the full effect, right? Like, I think I would rather play with all of our friends than just play with one of our friends.
I think that's a good point. Like, it's a good way potentially to introduce people to the game, or maybe play with a significant other, and then you can explore a lot of themes that you can't do with, like, you know, a random other gamer.
Yeah, I don't have any, like, I think solo play is great in the right situations. I just think, you know, given that we have a lot of history playing in our group, like, I think our group would be how I would prefer to invest in a campaign rather than the two of us solo.
But the real conclusion is whatever you out there think. So, I don't know. Let us know.
All right. Do you hear that, Ishan?
That is the door slamming on our actual play, because it is finally over. And I think it's in jail. I think that's where we put it. Maybe that's where it belongs.
It's going to horny jail.
Oh, stupid, sexy Meepo.
Yeah, Meepo's going to horny jail.
He has a charisma of 10 now. I'm pretty sure you're using his ASI on charisma.
Yes, the silk shirt was the equivalent of an ASI. All right, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at TotalPartyThrill.
And join the conversation on Discord. There's a link in the show notes. Before we wrap up, we want to take one more moment to thank our Patreon supporters.
Your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show now once again every single week. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out all of our rewards at patreon.com/TotalPartyThrill. All the proceeds go to Aram.
All right, so what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're talking about using voices, because we just did a bunch of that.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We're building the Big Talker.
Well, that's it for Actual Play Episode 15 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name. But either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.